This is an ABC podcast.
About 20 years ago, the field of psychology changed. It expanded. Until then, it was focused on all the things that can go wrong in people.
Problems, you know, particularly mental health problems, and how to treat and prevent them.
But if you wanted to know what went right, what made people flourish, live well, and function at their best, you were out of luck. Then, psychology researchers started investigating these exact topics, in the process, kickstarting a whole new stream of psychological study called positive psychology.
That's important because even if we've had a mental health problem, and it's incredibly important to get good treatment or preventive strategies, but even if we've had a problem, we don't want to just not have any more symptoms. We actually want our lives to go well. That's where positive psychology comes in.
But what does it mean to flourish and live well? How can we do that? And has the pandemic made it harder? Spoiler, the answer is yes, but there is still lots we can do. You're listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, the building blocks of well-being and living a good life. The first thing to know about well-being is that it's not the same as simply being happy or experiencing pleasure.
So happiness and pleasure can be very short-lived. Also, we can get happiness or pleasure from things that may not be very good for us in the longer term, alcohol or drugs or buying stuff that we think is going to make us happy. So well-being or flourishing is something that's more sustainable, something deeper.
Dr. Felicia Huppert is an emeritus professor of psychology at Cambridge University and honorary professor at Sydney University. She spent more than 15 years focused on the science of well-being, and she recently co-authored the book, Creating the World We Want to Live In: How Positive Psychology Can Build a Brighter Future. And well-being has become synonymous with things like yoga and green smoothies these days, but what Professor Huppert is talking about is broader than that.
In the book, based on the science and the research, we've come up with five principles that are pretty foundational for developing well-being. And the first of these is the importance of connection to others. We are social animals, and a sense of belonging is profoundly important for our well-being. And in fact, there's studies that show that if we feel socially excluded, it can cause as much pain as physical pain and activate the very same parts of the brain that are activated with physical pain. And of course, loneliness is something that people struggle with. And one of the antidotes to loneliness is finding ways to connect with others.
The pandemic has trashed a lot of the potential, though, for a lot of people to establish connections, maintain connections with others. Do you worry about the effect that's had on people's well-being?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the effects of the pandemic is recognizing how much we need those connections with others and how, you know, devastating it can be for our physical and mental, particularly our mental well-being when we don't have those connections. But equally, I've heard so many people express gratitude that we've had the technology that can keep us connected at least in some ways. You know, just imagining what this pandemic would have been like 20 years ago when, we didn't all have smartphones and Zoom wasn't around, it would have been an even worse picture.
After social connection, Professor Huppert says the second principle for well-being is having a sense of autonomy.
The sense that we can make choices and have some control over our lives.
Again, that's something the pandemic has made harder at the moment.
Of course, we can't have complete control or make choices because, we live in social contexts and we have to consider other people. But a good rule of thumb is treat others as you would wish to be treated.
The third principle is having a sense of competence.
A sense that, we're effective in what we do. And that's quite hard to do in new situations. But the important thing there is to be open to new experience, to recognize that we're not always going to manage well, and we might fail at things when we're not familiar with them. But to have a growth mindset and recognize that failure is not something that's an inadequacy in us, it's a growth opportunity. So that's a very important part of learning to be competent.
The fourth principle is paying attention to what's going well in life.
And we have this inbuilt negativity bias that probably helped us when we were evolving and needed to be vigilant, but it doesn't serve us very well anymore. And it turns out that our well-being is greatly increased if, instead of focusing on the negative, we focus on the positive. We look at our and other people's strengths rather than their deficits.
And the fifth and final principle for well-being is having a sense of meaning.
A sense that what we do is significant and worthwhile and makes a difference beyond the self. And there's lots of evidence that shows when people feel that their lives are meaningful or their work is meaningful, they just perform much, much better and they're much more fulfilled.
Together, these five principles cover what we need in order to achieve and maintain psychological well-being. Without these areas of our lives in check, we suffer. You talked about having a positive mindset, accepting that you won't always be competent at everything, but having a growth mindset. If you're someone who struggles to think in these ways and you're a bit negative or pessimistic, what can you or should you do?
It's a very good question. I think the first part is just knowing that it makes a difference. Absolutely, it's appropriate to be negative at times, to have disappointments and frustrations and sadness and anxiety and all of those things. But to recognize that actually it's also good to look for the positives, no matter how small, because they are very good for our health, for our relationships and for our capabilities as well. So just beginning with knowing that it's worth trying to look for these things, and even just in the course of a day, just once or twice, noticing something positive and then building that up to make it more of a habit can really make a difference in our lives.
How much of a difference? Well, if we just look at the potential impact on our physical health, it's pretty remarkable.
When we look at the relationship between mind and body, we know that that's a very important relationship that goes both ways. One good example of this is stress. Now, stress is something we feel in the mind, but it has profound effects on our bodies, on our cardiovascular system, on our immune function. But by the same token, positive emotions have an effect on our bodies.
There's a curious series of experiments that demonstrate this, led by psychology professor Sheldon Cohen from Carnegie Mellon University. He took a large group of healthy volunteers and, using nasal drops, he gave them the cold virus.
And then he put them in quarantine. And he had measured their positivity beforehand, and he found that those people who had a more positive approach to life were much less likely to develop the common cold.
That's fascinating.
Or if they did, they recovered much more quickly. So positive emotions do have a direct effect on reducing stress, increasing our immune function, and reducing inflammatory problems. And there's even been studies showing that positive emotions increase the antibody response to vaccines. Mm. It hasn't been done with the COVID vaccine yet, but there are studies looking at either the flu vaccine or the hepatitis B vaccine shows that when people are in positive mood states, they produce more antibodies. And I think that's something that is very interesting for us to know.
So looking for the positives, having a sense of meaning, being socially connected are all principles that contribute to well-being. But if you feel like you're missing some of these from your life and you're struggling to figure out what you can do, Professor Huppert says there are three core characteristics that underpin the principles. Cultivate those and you put yourself in better stead for gaining and maintaining well-being.
What we've learned from the science is that there are three core capabilities that underlie the principles for well-being. And we call them open mind, open heart, and clear thinking. And an open mind is all about seeing things more clearly. And the way we do that is paying attention to what's going on around us and also what's going on inside us as we're experiencing it. So this allows us to be aware of our thoughts, our emotions, our sensations, but also our values and our biases. And another way of describing this is it's mindful awareness. So, for example, rather than reacting instantly to things and making judgments about everything that's happening, we pause and we take the time to think, what would be the wisest way of responding to whatever it is we're experiencing? You know, whether it's something that a person has triggered or some event in our lives. So this pause gives us an opportunity to act more wisely and make better choices. But it also does something else, and it allows us to stay with difficult experiences, to just sit with them, allow them to be there, recognize that they're perfectly valid, but at the same time to savor the positive ones. So it creates emotional balance in our lives.
When you say sit with negative experiences, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is we often have a tendency when things are difficult to sort of push them away, to avoid them, to seek distraction and so on. But it turns out that it's actually quite beneficial for our mental health and our well-being if we can actually let them be, acknowledge that it is perfectly legitimate to have these difficult feelings, that it's just part of being human, and not let them overwhelm us, but just have an accepting and kindly and curious attitude towards them. Oh gosh, I feel really anxious right now. I wonder what that's about.
Do you think most of us struggle though to change our thinking in this way?
I think for very many of us, it is a struggle initially because it's so different to our usual ways of doing things. In fact, most of our lives, I think we're pretty much on autopilot, you know, just rushing through and reacting. But the ways in which we react are often not at all helpful. So it can take some time to get used to the idea of, you know, sitting with whatever the experience is. But it is a very, very helpful practice. Once we can get to a point where we've got emotional balance in our lives, that really is a very good place to be from the perspective of our mental health and our well-being.
Having an open heart helps in that regard too. It's the second capability Professor Huppert mentioned.
So an open heart is about kindness and compassion. And it's interesting because I think we are hardwired for kindness. And you can see examples in very small children coming to the aid of a stranger who's dropped something. And when we behave in those ways, it leads to enduring and deeper relationships. And the third of what we call core capabilities is clear thinking. We're bombarded with information, and it's really important to be able to evaluate it, to work out, you know, what's true, what we need to act on. And of course, it's particularly hard these days with so much misinformation and false news. But there are ways to do this. First of all, to think about what are trusted and reliable sources. Also to expose ourselves to other kinds of information that might disagree with what we're used to and try and work out, okay, so there are these different ways of looking at things. Which one is more likely to be right?
A study involving school children in Uganda provides an example for how clear thinking can be cultivated from a young age. The study, published in 2017 in The Lancet, focused on 9-year-olds and teaching them how to critically assess claims about medical treatment.
In Uganda, there's a lot of myths about medical treatments, like the idea that you can cure HIV and AIDS with certain herbs. So 9-year-old children were taught how to tell if medical claims are likely to be true. This was 11,000 kids were randomized in their schools. And after just 9 lessons, they were extraordinarily good at detecting what was likely to be correct information and what wasn't. For instance, it was beautiful to hear in their own words them describing why it's important to do randomized controlled trials. And at the end, 3/4 of this group passed an exam on how to assess medical information, whereas only 1/4 of the control group were able to pass the exam. So there are ways to do this.
You're listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Kadar. Today, the building blocks of well-being. Dr. Felicia Huppert is an Emeritus Professor of Psychology and Founding Director of the Wellbeing Institute at Cambridge University. She's also co-author of the book, Creating the World We Want to Live In: How Positive Psychology Can Build a Brighter Future. Synthesizing two decades of research on what makes humans thrive, it's an instruction manual for what we need in order to live well. The book also explores the broader factors that influence our lives, focusing on childhood, education, work, and aging, and considers how these domains can be optimized for well-being. I want to start by asking you about education, though, and I can imagine how education would impact someone's life, but how does it impact someone's well-being more specifically?
What we learn and how we learn it make a huge difference to the way we see the world and ourselves in the world. So if learning has been enjoyable, this can last us throughout life, empowering us and so on in whatever we do later. But if the learning experience has been very negative, if we've been told we're stupid or lazy or a troublemaker, this too can have major effects later in our lives. So it's profoundly important that the learning environment is an environment that values everybody, that sees potential in all children and tries to develop that potential.
Do you think education needs to be done differently to how it is now in order to be more effective? What does the evidence say?
Yeah, there's still so much emphasis on knowledge and getting good grades, but all the evidence shows us that it's just as important to learn the skills we need for life, not just the skills that we need for getting a good job. And in fact, UNESCO now has these four pillars of education. So one of them is learning to know, which is, about knowledge. Another is learning to do, which is about implementing the knowledge and being creative and innovative, but also learning how to work with teams. The third is how to live together, and that's profoundly important. It's about understanding others, about respecting different perspectives, managing conflict. And the fourth is learning to be. And that's learning to be your best self, learning to be autonomous, learning to take responsibility. And I think these four pillars, if they became part of school curricula, I think they would change everything. Because we know that when young children do have a high level of well-being, they are much better learners, as well as much kinder to each other. So you don't need anti-bullying programs when you've got people who right from the beginning have learned about the importance of kindness to each other in their school setting.
How much of a difference can this really make, though? Well, consider the city of Glasgow.
There were real problems in Glasgow with very large rates of permanent exclusion from school and also high rates of youth crime. But a group of people in the Department of Education got together and decided to take a nurturing approach.
This was back in 2001.
And what that meant was that they recognised that every child had potential. And also they had high expectations of each child and provided a great deal of support. And it had profound effects. So, for example, since 2017, there were no permanent exclusions from schools. Half the students went on to do their final exams. There was a 50% reduction in youth crime. Most children went on to do their final school exams, and two-thirds went on to tertiary education. So it really was a profound turnaround.
And in terms of what you were speaking about before, how education should be not just about learning, but learning how to implement it, how to be with others, I can think of so many ways in which the pandemic would have disrupted that over the past year and a bit.
Oh, absolutely. It's extraordinary to read that over 90% of the world's children were homeschooled at some point during the pandemic, and that's 1.6 billion children were affected. There was so much less about learning to do, learning to work together. So those are things that are going to be really, really important, as well as the knowledge to catch up on when schools resume in Australia and other parts of the world.
Okay, let's talk about work and well-being. We spend most of our lives at work, so it's no surprise that, you know, work can contribute to or harm our well-being. But how does it do that in more detail?
So the first thing to say is that unemployment is worse for well-being than the quality of work. So unemployment really is a problem. So that having said, you know, work is better than no work, but we know from studies that enormous numbers of people are not enjoying their work and not feeling engaged with their work. But we also know that the more they do feel positive about their jobs, the greater the effect on them and on the workplace as well. There have been some analyses of many, many studies on millions of people showing a strong link between how positive people feel about their job and how well they do and how well their company does. So when people do feel positive about their work, they're much more likely to be productive and creative. They're much more likely to be loyal to the company and need fewer days of sick leave. And from the company's point of view, there's also evidence that their profits are greater when they have employees with high levels of well-being. So there's very good reasons for companies to prioritize the well-being of their employees. And in fact, just last year, the economic summit in Davos suggested that all organizations should think about purpose beyond profit. And among the most important purposes are investing in employees, caring about customers and suppliers, increasing diversity and inclusion, and also looking at environmental impacts of what's happening in the workplace.
And as we're building our careers, we're aging, and that poses its own range of challenges. What does the research tell us about aging well and how we can do it?
Living a long and healthy life is something that's absolutely new in human history. At the end of the 19th century, there was the idea of, you know, retirement, and the reason age 60 was suggested was hardly anyone lived that long, and those who did were very, very frail and ill. But nowadays, we can expect to live 10, 20, even 30 years after what we still think of as retirement age. And it can be an incredibly enriching period of our lives where we contribute to maybe looking after grandchildren, where we can do creative things.
Of course, many people also face challenges as they age with their health or their memory.
But these can be overcome or reduced to some degree if we look after ourselves physically, mentally, and socially. But there's a classic study asking the question, can you teach an old dog new tricks? And a group of people between 60 and 90 were divided. Half of them were taught a language, namely German, and half were taught to play a musical instrument, which was the recorder. And those are two things we normally think only kids can pick up easily. And what was extraordinary was after just 3 months of learning German, these elderly people passed an exam that kids don't sit until they've been learning for 3 years. Mm. And in case of the recorder playing, they did so well that they went on to create a recorder troupe and traveled around performing. So, yes, memory does get worse. Yes, there are problems with mobility and sensory function and health, but there's so much we can do about it.
One of the most important things we can do is try and maintain our social connections as much as possible.
There's studies showing that if you account for everything else, like a person's age and health and education and their income and all of that, the people who receive social support live longer and more healthily than those who have less social support. But even more important is the fact that if you account for all those background variables and how much social support someone receives, the thing that really determines how well and healthily they live is the support they give to others. This is something that comes up time and again, that our well-being, our health, our life expectancy is related more to what we do for others than what we get from others. And I think very often with older people, we're so busy looking after them that we forget that they have so much to offer, you know, whether it's looking after an even older neighbour. So this doing things for others helps both parties, the recipients, but also the givers.
And I guess if anyone listening is, you know, feeling quite negative about aging, there are some positives to look forward to. You write about in the book the fact that older people have better vocabulary, communication skills, and older people are generally happier as well.
Yes, those things are certainly true. And people often find it surprising that on measures of happiness, older folk do come out better. But I think that's it's certainly not all older people. It's those who are fortunate enough to be well enough to lead the kind of life they've chosen after work. Of course, for some of us, we continue to work, and the studies are usually done on retired people. And some people can't afford to retire and have the kind of life they'd like to lead. But when people do, when they slow down and make choices about how they'd like to lead their lives, then certainly they seem to be happier.
Overall, what do you think the pandemic has shown us about the importance of well-being? And how do you think the era we're in right now has crystallized the importance of positive psychology, your field of research?
It's certainly shown us the importance of our interconnectedness to our communities and to the world at large, and how the way every choice we make, every action we take has impacts way beyond us, and that we do need to think about those. But more specifically, I think what it's shown us is the importance of being prepared so that next time we encounter difficulties, whether it's a pandemic, a recession, or something in our personal lives, we already have the knowledge, the skills, the resources to better manage these difficulties that are inevitably going to happen. It's about the need for better preparation.
What do you mean by that? Prepared in what way?
The kind of preparation I'm talking about is having the mental resources to deal with whatever happens to us. And it's about training the mind through those various capabilities that I spoke about, through having an open mind or mindful awareness, having an open heart, which is kindness and compassion, and also clear thinking. Because those three together lead to wise action in whatever the circumstances, no matter how difficult.
And obviously positive psychology is the focus of your work, but in your personal life, how do you employ some of these practices?
I try to do a mindfulness meditation each morning, even if it's just 10 minutes or something. And what that involves is, sitting and just getting in touch with what's going on in my body, what's going on with my thoughts and my emotions. And then at the end of the day, I think about three good things that happened. It's not always easy, but I end up always being able to either think of three good things that happened or bad things that didn't happen. And when I do manage to do that, I find it's both relaxing, it brings a sense of peace and helps me sleep more easily.
Those are great practices to have. And I guess finally, for people reading the book, if they take away one sort of thing from it, what do you hope that message is?
I think the important thing that comes up in all the different sections of the book, in everything from childhood through aging and work and society and politics and economics and the environment, is the importance of moving away from our focus on the self, on the individual and our own wants and achievements, and looking more broadly at how we relate to other people around us. So the way we put it is the key thing is moving from me to we and from a short-term focus to a longer-term focus, so that not only are things good for us now, but also for future generations.
That's Dr. Felicia Huppert, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Cambridge University, Honorary Professor at Sydney University, and co-author of the book Creating the World We Want to Live In: How Positive Psychology Can Build a Brighter Future. That's it for All in the Mind this week. Our producer is James Bullen. Sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Sana Kadar. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.